Welcome to The Productivity Show, the Asian Efficiency Podcast dedicated to helping you make the most of your time, attention, energy, and focus. In this episode, Brooks and I talk about cognitive biases and how they influence our ability to make good, rational decisions. We dive into the sources of cognitive biases, talk about many of the most common culprits to bad decision-making, and explain four strategies that you can use to help yourself overcome your own cognitive biases and make better decisions. This is a pretty heavy topic, but it's an important one as the average person makes over 35,000 decisions every single day. So recognizing where your brain may attempt to shortcut the decision-making progress is important if you don't want to end up making a decision that you'll come to regret later. You can find links to everything that we share in the show notes by going to theproductivityshow.com/152. And now, on with the show. All right, so today we're going to be talking about cognitive biases. And this is something that I know John had mentioned in the dojo a while back. And so there's a lot here, and I am definitely not an expert, but I am very fascinated by this topic. And with me to talk about cognitive biases today is Mr. Brooks Duncan. How are you doing today, Brooks?
I'm excellent. I'm really excited about this topic because, as I think we're going to dive into, this is something that is huge in the productivity industry. It plays a part in everything to do with productivity. So I think we'll be having some fun examples.
Yeah, this will be a fun discussion, but like I said, definitely not experts in this particular area, but just doing the research for this show has been actually very illuminating. And so hopefully by the end of this episode, you'll have a much better idea of what some of your own cognitive biases are, and you'll be able to identify that you do actually use these, and then we'll share some strategies at the end to help you overcome them at a high level. But maybe let's start here by talking about, what is a cognitive bias anyways? And so the definition of a cognitive bias from the Wikipedia page is the systematic pattern of deviation from norm or rationality in judgment, whereby inferences about other people and situations may be drawn in an illogical fashion. So what that basically means is that they are things that color your ability to make a good decision. And a lot of times you don't even realize that this stuff is happening, which is why we're going to be talking about it today.
Yeah. And like I said, it's big in productivity. So many things we think are the key to success actually come from cognitive bias. So that's a perfect definition.
Yeah. And it's a byproduct of the human processing limitations or limited capacity for the information processing. It's essentially shortcuts that your brain tries to take to improve the decision-making process and not use as much mental energy to make these decisions. Tan and I talked about how the average person makes over 35,000 decisions every day. So I can definitely understand why your brain might feel like you need a break. But it is important to recognize some of these cognitive biases because a lot of times they can color very important decisions, like whether to make a career change, like we talked about in episode 148, I believe it was. It's the one that actually, as we're recording this, just posted. So there was one where we talked about hitting the reset button. And so there's a lot of things, you know, maybe you're unhappy about your particular situation and you tend to focus on the negative things that are in that particular situation. That's an example of a cognitive bias. And so we need to understand what impact these actually have. And so there's essentially four different sources of cognitive bias that I was able to find from my research. And then we'll just go through these real quickly so you can kind of understand what might trigger a cognitive bias. And then we'll get into a lot of different examples because there are a ton of different examples. All right. So the first thing that can contribute to a cognitive bias is you've got too much information. There's just too much information physically coming into your brain for your brain to process it all. And so it looks for shortcuts. Number two is not enough meaning. So the information that's coming into your brain doesn't have the necessary meaning associated with it to weight it properly. Number three would be the need to act quickly. So you need to make this decision right away. And so your brain is going to look for ways to make a good decision as quickly as possible without maybe collecting all of the facts. And then number four is the actual physical limits of our memory. All right, so sources of cognitive bias, real quickly, again, number one, too much information. Number two, not enough meaning. Number three, the need to act quickly. And number four, the limits of memory. And now the fun part, we are going to get into a lot of different examples of cognitive bias. All right. So the number one cognitive bias, and there's actually a list of these, which is on the Wikipedia page. They've got a list of common cognitive biases. And the first one they define is the fundamental attribution error. And this is the tendency for people to overemphasize personality-based explanations for behaviors which they observe in other people. So my view of this is kind of, we tend to, way of explaining this might be that we tend to judge other people by their actions, but we judge ourselves by our intentions.
Yeah, it's that whole thing, you know, we judge other people by their outsides and ours by our insides. So we're comparing those things as well.
Yep, definitely. And so again, you know, we're going to, at the end of this, talk about some specific strategies that you can do, that you can implement to overcome these different cognitive biases at a high level. But for now, what we're going to do is just kind of go through a bunch of these different ones. And so fundamental attribution error would be the first one on the list. And then number two, according to the list at Wikipedia, is confirmation bias. So this is the tendency to search for or interpret information in a way that confirms our own preconceptions. So we look for things to validate our view of things instead of looking at it objectively.
Yeah. An example that springs to mind on this is, Say you have a website and you make some change, like you change the color of a button or you make some other change, and then traffic to your website goes up. And so your first thinking is, all right, the change I made worked, but did it really? You know, maybe you got linked to from something else. There could be a million reasons why the traffic on your website went up, but we think that because we made this change, we think that's the reason it happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And the comment you made here is that the productivity space is full of this. Absolutely. Because you try something and then you say, oh, hey, that must have worked because I got this result. And you apply that result to what you did. And that's an example of the confirmation bias. It's essentially seeing the confirmation that you made the right choice. Another example I can think of with this, I have this bad habit where if I am going to buy something, I'll generally do a little bit of research beforehand, but like I bought a Tonbin Synapse 25 backpack not too long ago. We were actually talking about this on the dojo. And after the fact, like you buy the thing and then it's going to take a week to get there because they've got to make it. And what do? I go and I look for reviews and I see all of the awesome reviews, people saying how great this backpack is. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I made the right choice.
Oh yeah. Oh, I do that a lot. And yeah, the productivity space example, I try really hard to be careful about this because if a lot of productivity advice you see, they just say, this is the one true way you should do things. But really, that's not how it is. You know, just because something worked well for me, like let's say for me, meditating has had wonderful benefits. Well, just because meditating's had wonderful benefits for me doesn't necessarily mean that that is the key to productivity. It can be a key. So you got to be careful about the cognitive bias when you're giving advice.
Yeah. And in the chat, Nate's asking, how can you avoid confirmation bias when analyzing data results? That's a really great question because I know that when you're looking at data, you can make it say just about anything that you want. So I would say, and this is just my my interpretation, I guess, of this would be to get outside perspectives to look at the data as well. So like one of the things that we do is we have our weekly team meeting, and everybody's got their functional area of accountability where we are responsible for certain metrics. And I'll be looking at my metrics and say, the churn rate is this, and you know it went up or it went down, and I think it might be because of this. And Tan's got different numbers that he's bringing to the meeting, and Brooks, you've got different numbers that you're bringing to the meeting. And then when we piece these together, you know, Tan can offer different perspectives. Like, well, actually, you know, we were doing this in the marketing and that impacted the dojo in this particular way. So I think that the more perspectives that you get, like Katie mentions peer review, absolutely. That's definitely one way that you could overcome it. You have any other examples of how you might avoid confirmation bias when analyzing data or results?
Well, I think Katie's right. I think peer review is the best one. Having someone else who doesn't have skin in the game, so to speak, look at this stuff is a big one. Also, I think testing as well. So if you're making a change to your website, see, okay, well, what other changes have happened as far as, you know, external links and stuff like that, for example, but also testing over time. So checking it, you make a change and then you test it over time. And is this change that you're seeing sticking, or was it, you know, a one-time thing? So that could be another thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nate mentions your inner circle, your mastermind. I think that that's the best value of a mastermind group, and the accountability is that, you know, you're going to say, I'm going to do this thing. And then other people can say, well, first of all, they can hold you accountable to doing that thing. But then also they can say, you didn't think about this, or you're not seeing this particular part of the situation, and just having those different perspectives. And I don't know. I mean, Brooks, I'm not sure if you have any experience with a mastermind group. I do a little bit. I wouldn't confess to be an expert, but I've noticed that that's the big thing from us, is that we meet fairly regularly, and then everybody just is able to offer a different perspective and kind of help you see your blind spots. It's not even necessarily like the expertise that's in the room that's helping you overcome the problems necessarily. It's just pointing things out that you tend to overlook, even sometimes obvious things, because of these cognitive biases.
Yeah, it's the same thing. A lot of times, like you said, they'll think of things you didn't think of, but they'll also call you on your biases, because if you are emotionally attached to a certain thing, you're going to color your view of that. So somebody who, like I said, doesn't have that kind of emotional attachment to it can look at it more objectively.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. The next one on the list here is a self-serving bias. And so this is the tendency to claim more responsibility for your successes than failures. So when you succeed, it's because you did something great, you made the right decision, but when you fail, it's not your fault.
This is a big one with parents, I would say.
Definitely.
When your kid does something amazing, you raised them right, and when they don't, it's, you know, they're loser friends or whatever. So yeah, I think that's a big one, and that is also a big one in work as well. You know, it's that thing. I'm going to butcher the example, but I'm just making this up, but you know, you do some survey and it's like 70% of the people think that they are the most important person in the office or whatever. So obviously that can't be true. But we just think of ourselves that way.
Yeah. And kind of related to this, I would say would be, and we're kind of jumping all over the place here, so I apologize, but I think this could also be classified under the self-serving bias, is this overconfidence, where we tend to overvalue our own skills and our own abilities, which, you know, we're talking about the masterminds. That's why having a community or having people like that who can point out the stuff that you're missing is important, because you, to a certain degree, like, you can recognize that this stuff is there, and you can take steps to overcome it by yourself, but you still can't see your blind spots. Like, you can know that there might be something in that blind spot, but it's a lot easier for somebody outside the situation to say, hey, there's something there that you're not seeing.
Yeah. And Nate also makes a very good point that the mastermind should be diverse and not just a groupthink / bandwagon. And I would add to that, and I would say the people it doesn't have to be a mastermind, but whoever you're surrounding yourself with needs to have that level of honesty as well. So they're not just saying yes to be polite. There has to be that safety that you can call somebody out on their biases without worrying that it's going to, you know, wreck a relationship or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely been in situations where you haven't been able to, at least I've felt, you know, you haven't been able to be honest about what I'm seeing in a particular situation. And if you can get everybody in your group or your mastermind, your community on the same page and be like, okay, I just want the truth. Even if it hurts, like, tell me what you see. That's very, very beneficial. But you can't just go into whatever team or organization that you're a part of and say, okay, this is the way that I work either. You definitely have to make sure that everybody is on the same page with that. So that's kind of, it's kind of not necessarily cognitive biases. That's getting into the setting expectations and things like that. But it is important, since we're talking about this mastermind or overcoming that groupthink, that you have those expectations in place. All right. Next one on this list of the common cognitive biases, or the more commonly studied cognitive biases anyways, is the belief bias. And this is where your evaluation of the logical strength of an argument is biased by your belief in the truth or the falsity of a conclusion. And so this is essentially just projecting a right or wrong value on one particular viewpoint. And that obviously can be very dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just think of how much better politics, for example, would be if we could avoid that, because in any situation, you have people who are arguing against something or arguing for something that maybe, 4 years ago or whatever, they were arguing against, because it serves their beliefs at the time.
Yeah. And a different way of describing this would be the conservatism bias, which is not wanting to accept new ideas as true. And the example that I found to go along with this would be the fact that people are slow to accept, even nowadays, like common facts, like the belief that the earth is round, for example. Took a very long time for people to actually believe that, or the majority to believe that, because they had this very firmly entrenched view of this is the truth, and anything against that is going to by default be projected as false.
Yeah, and even today there's flat earth societies that try to say that it's not round. So, and Nate makes a good point. He says, you know, it's irrational and devolves into arguments and shouting matches. And it's true. Like, and it's not just the most obvious example I used was politics, but it could be anything. It could be, you know, iOS versus Android. It could be Mac versus Windows. Back in the day, people instantly dislike something from the other side, regardless of what features or applicability it has. Because it's the other, they just discount it right away. And it's very difficult to change minds in that scenario.
Yeah, definitely. And do you have any tips, I guess, Brooks, for how you might overcome that one and have a honest and open discussion without triggering people's beliefs that their particular view is right? I think that this is a very sticky and very tricky subject to navigate, but I think that it's worth spending some time to identify the right way to overcome these sorts of things, because like you said, it can very quickly result in the shouting match. It's like, I got to listen to people. Yeah, but that's a really good point. And it sounds very simple, but I guess, like, what does that look like to, like, for example, one example I think of off the top of my head is the whole idea of like active listening, where you're repeating back what the other person has said to make sure that you're hearing it right. I think that could help you overcome some of these cognitive biases, but anything else that you can think of for diffusing these situations and having these open and honest conversations?
Well, I think for me, one of them is, well, listening is the big one for sure. Acknowledgement also, acknowledging that, not in a fake way, you know, the, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way sort of thing, but acknowledging that, you know, the person that is a belief that somebody has, and you can understand why they might have that, even if you don't necessarily, but at least, you know, at least try, and basically make it so it's not judgmental and about the person. So you could say, well, I feel this way because of X, Y, Z. but I can see why you would feel this way. And instead of saying like, what's the matter with you? Why do you feel this way? Because then you're attacking the person. You're not sharing your beliefs. That's, or not your beliefs, but you're sharing your perspective. And also, I'm really glad that Nate said something in the chat just now, because this is a saying that I heard the first time, I think, from John Gruber. But Nate said one of his mentors advocated this stance, and it's strong opinions weakly held. So we're not saying that you can't have strong opinions and really stand up for yourself. Like, definitely you have beliefs, stand up for them, but be also open to the fact that you might be wrong. What you believe may not actually be right. That other person may be correct in this case. So at least be open to that possibility, because you just never know.
Yeah. Sean McCabe of Sean West had a podcast episode recently called the communication episode, which was really, really good. I actually had my wife listen to it, and then we talked about it at one of our family meetings. But I think that that's very applicable to this conversation, because a lot of this comes down to communication and soft skills, essentially, where what you have to communicate is the fact that you are hearing the other person and that you are valuing their view, even if you continue to disagree with it. And that is not an easy thing to do sometimes, especially with certain personality types that can naturally escalate into that shouting match that we were talking about in the dojo chat. But I think what it comes down to is, when you are communicating, the responsibility for the accuracy of the message and whether it is being received correctly is on you as the sender. It is not on the other person. The other person, Sean McKibb, makes a point that even if they can recite it back to you word for word, they may not have received the message. And so there's definitely a lot here in terms of how do you send and receive a message correctly. But I think that part of the process here is identifying that the cognitive biases are going to naturally hinder that communication process.
Yeah. And sometimes you're not going to agree on things, and that's fine. Like, you don't have to win other people to your side all the time. That's the other thing. You can find common ground without getting into this big mess also.
Yeah, exactly. And another cognitive bias kind of leads into the bandwagon effect, because we want to be right. And that's what this bandwagon effect bias is all about. It's adopting a belief because a number of other people believe a certain way. And especially when you're talking about sensitive subjects like politics or religion, you tend to surround yourself with people who have similar mindsets, and you get into this groupthink mindset. But that's comforting to a certain degree, and you feel like you've made the right decision because everybody is doing it this particular way.
I'm going to be totally honest and put my hand up. When I first chose OmniFocus as my task manager, to take it out of politics for a second, when I first chose OmniFocus as my task manager, it wasn't because necessarily I sat down and made a rational list of the features that I needed in a task manager and compared that to OmniFocus and did it. I ended up going with it initially because a lot of people that I really respected and seemed very smart to me were using OmniFocus as their task manager. So that's pretty much why I chose it in the first place. Now, it turned out to work out really well, and I still love it to this day. But that is an example of, I basically jumped on that particular bandwagon for my task manager.
So that kind of bias actually served its purpose.
Exactly. It all worked out for me.
that's funny, though. Another kind of related cognitive bias here is the pre-innovation bias. And this is overvaluing the contribution of a specific technology. And so an example of this, I believe, is the shiny new object syndrome. We hear from people all the time. They want to know, what specific app do we recommend for this? You know, and the belief a lot of times is that if they just had the right app, or they just adopted the right system, that all of a sudden that everything is just gonna work out. So with apps specifically, you know, as soon as I download OmniFocus, my life is gonna be better. Well, OmniFocus is a great tool and puts a and puts forth a framework which will help you make sure that you are getting the right things done. Just having the app isn't necessarily going to get you where you want to go. And so we can tend to chase the next new thing, hoping that when we find that next new thing, that is going to be the thing that's going to make everything click.
It would be hilarious to go back and almost keep a running list of, like, go back to various, say, Mac websites or something like that, and every year look back at what people were freaking out about. Oh, this is so awesome, you got to have this tool, year by year, and the stuff that seemed awesome but made no long-term dent. It would be hilarious.
Yep, definitely. And Nate points out the narrow framing cognitive bias, which actually is not something necessarily that is on this list that we've got here, but framing is essentially using a too narrow of an approach and description of the situation or the issue. I think that you could probably apply that to a lot of different situations. We'll just keep it on task managers, I guess. So you could say that, for example, the best task manager is without a doubt OmniFocus. And if you are, especially on the agent efficiency team, you could be looking at this through the lens of the best Mac app specifically, but you're not taking into account everything that is available. And that's one of the things we get accused of all the time, is like we're too focused on the Apple stuff, and there's all these different things for PC users, which you're right, Nate, you know, we sometimes focus on the tree instead of the forest. And there's a lot of stuff that falls into the productivity realm that is outside our particular area of expertise, but that we should be considering when we're going to make a blanket statement like that. We want to make sure that when we are framing this, that we're considering everything that all the different inputs, essentially.
Yeah, that's why I try not to say some tool or some platform is the best ...
Yep.
Because it may be the best for me, but there could be another one that is even better for me. It's just the one that I choose to use. So the best is rarely the best. And just because it's the best for me does not necessarily mean it's the best for you.
Definitely. And, you know, I apologize right now because I'm sure I've done that before. But yeah, darn cognitive biases. Kind of related to that is a selective perception, where you are allowing your expectations to influence how you see the world. I think that, you know, this could also kind of fall into the narrow framing category. But one great example of this, I believe, is like if you're a sports fan, for example. I live in Wisconsin, and so the Green Bay Packers are the local NFL team, and they're a pretty big deal. The entire community in north central Wisconsin, like, they live, breathe, eat, sleep the Packers. And so their arch rival is the Chicago Bears, and people absolutely hate the Bears, but it has nothing to do with the actual Bears organization, or a lot of times even the players on the Bears. But they project that, oh, because you are on our arch enemy's team, you must all be a bunch of jerks. That's an example of selective perception.
Yeah, I'm a big soccer, as we call it in North America, or football for the rest of the world, fan, and that's ingrained in so many leagues and so many cultures. If you're a Premier League fan and you're a supporter of, say, Arsenal, you just hate Tottenham Hotspur and vice versa. And it sometimes goes into violence as people are going to and from the tube station. And it happens in the rest of the world as well. And there's no real reason for it, but it's just how it is. Yep.
All right. So yeah, Nate Lowry mentions that he's a Cowboys fan. So Nate and I probably have selective perception, cognitive biases towards one another's favorite teams. So that's important to recognize. And then also, I think that kind of related to that is this whole stereotyping cognitive bias, where you can project certain qualities on a group of people without having any information to validate it one way or the other. And this is obviously a lot broader than just sports, but I think that you could definitely see how this could be played out in the sports arena.
Yeah. Hiring, for example, is a huge thing. There's been studies done where people who have names for, you know, identical resumes, identical backgrounds, identical everything, but they have their names, which may be associated with a certain type of ethnicity or whatever, they get X percent, huge percent too, less called in for an interview. And the only difference is the name. So it just is crazy how deadly stereotyping can be. And it, the worst thing about that is it can be generational, it can be ingrained, and it can be subconscious as well. Like these hiring managers don't even know they're doing it necessarily. They're not sitting there looking at this pile of resumes saying, oh, this person is X, so forget it, bottom of the pile. It's something that happens subconsciously. So it's a real problem.
Yeah, definitely. I don't really know how to transition. That's a pretty heavy topic. I mean, there's huge discussions about like pay inequality, for example, and that kind of gets into this whole stereotyping, cognitive bias. But I guess without a real clean segue, maybe let's talk about something a little bit lighter. Let's talk about the anchoring bias. So this is where you are over-reliant on the first piece of information that you receive. So this could be, for example, going back to the task managers, like if you were to find something initially and it's your first foray into the task management section, that this is the thing that kind of wins your heart. For example, Things was the task manager that kind of got me into the productivity space. So Things has kind of always had a soft spot for me. And when Things 3 came out, you know, I found myself going back to it because the app that kind of got me into the productivity space has been updated, and I wanted to see what was new, when really, if I was thinking about this objectively, I've got my entire life inside of OmniFocus. Why would I even think about looking at these different task managers, you know? And definitely an example of a cognitive bias.
Yeah, this has really done a lot with pricing as well. This is the first thing that comes to mind when I think of anchoring bias is, say, if you're presenting something for sale and maybe there's, I don't know, different versions of it or something, what a lot of times salespeople will do, let's say jewelry sales or something, what they'll do is they'll show somebody a really expensive ring first, and then they'll go in and show them the ring that they really think the person's going to buy. And that second one will be less expensive. And so it will seem, quote unquote, cheap or less expensive by comparison, even though maybe the person didn't even plan to spend that much. But because they've anchored the price to that higher price one, it just seems more reasonable. So this is a really powerful technique.
Yeah, and actually it kind of leads into the choice supportive bias also, because when you have that information and you make your choice, then you tend to think that your choice was the right one, and that your choice doesn't have the flaws that are associated with the other choices. So specifically, as that might pertain to anchoring, for example, you might say, well, I chose the one that is less expensive, and so at least it doesn't cost as much as that thing, you know? And so you kind of, again, like the confirmation bias, but really what you are projecting is that the choice that you made is the correct one given the information that you have, and you don't even see the negative ramifications of the choice that you just made.
It's like Tannen on OmniFocus.
Yep. Another one is the availability heuristic, and this is overestimating the importance of the information that is available to you. So you've got certain information and you see certain things happening, and then you use that information to validate a specific viewpoint. So for example, you might have an example of the availability heuristic cognitive bias would be something like believing that smoking really isn't that unhealthy because you know someone who lived to be 100 and they smoked 3 packs a day. You know, you've got one data point, and there's a lot of other things that go into that. But I think, you know, whether you smoke or not making a value judgment on the activity itself, I think we can all kind of agree based on the information in the medical field that it's not helping you necessarily live longer. Okay, but you may personally believe that, oh, it's really not doing anything negative to my body. And that would be an example of the availability heuristic if you're basing that viewpoint on the fact that you did, you knew somebody personally who kind of bucked that trend.
Yeah, and it's similar to, you can also give additional weight to things that is maybe all the information's available, but some of it is easier to get than others. You will just gravitate towards the information that's easy to retrieve instead of anything that has to, you have to go digging for it. So that can be another one as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So survivorship bias, I think, is also kind of related to this, where this is where you concentrate on things and people that made it. So they were successful, while you ignore the ones that didn't make it, because typically you hear about the people who are successful, and then this can kind of make you overestimate your chances for success. So there were a couple of examples here. One would be copying a successful company, even if you don't know why they were successful, because there's a lot of different factors that go into it. People can, and companies can make it look easy when it's really not.
Yeah. And that happens all the time. And a lot of times the company doesn't even know why they were successful. You know, maybe one of the founders was eating at a diner and happened to sit beside somebody, and that person was a connection that ended up leading to them being successful, but they don't really associate that. So they think they're the greatest entrepreneurs ever, and everyone else looks at them and thinks they're the greatest entrepreneurs ever, but maybe it was just happens to be a fluke. But we all associate that greatness with that person. So people try to model it, or somebody will want to be a writer and they'll think, oh, you know, I want to be like Hemingway, so I'm going to go, you know, whatever, live in a cabin in Cuba and use this certain type of typewriter and drink daiquiris when maybe that's not what made Hemingway successful. You also see this a lot with athletes. I'm in Canada, so my example is hockey, but you know, everyone thinks their little Jimmy is going to make it to the NHL if they play ice hockey. So parents get really crazy and spend tons of money when chances are little Jimmy is probably not going to make it to the NHL. But we have that survivorship bias because maybe we've seen somebody from our town make it or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I did some research a while back, and I found that at the time when I did the research, I'm not sure the numbers are accurate anymore, but in the US there were 550,000 high school students that play basketball every year, and 30 of them are going to make it to the NBA. So if you do the math, like, that's a very, very small percentage, but everybody who is playing, I should say everybody, cognitive bias, but a good number of those people believe that they've got a legitimate shot, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just because they focus on the success stories.
Yeah. And you got to be careful. Like, a certain element of this is good in the sense that you do have to have belief, right? You can't walk around thinking to yourself, oh, I'm probably not going to make it. You know, you have to have that focus on the end goal and belief. I mean, no one would ever start a company if it wasn't the case, mm-hmm. but you have to be careful with that. It's a fine line, right? You've got to believe in yourself, but you also can't be ridiculous either.
Yep, definitely. I'm laughing because Nate's put in the chat. It says, my mom said I'm special at basketball.
All right, Nate, let us know when your first NBA game is, and we'll make sure to tune in.
Yeah, let's see. I'm just looking through this list. I'm not sure we're going to get to all of these. Maybe let's look at the clustering illusion. I think this one is really interesting. The clustering illusion is where you tend to see patterns in random events. So an example of this, which I totally have experienced, is that you buy a car, for example, and then when you're driving around, you see the car that you just bought everywhere and you never noticed it before you bought it.
That is the example that popped to my mind as well, because it's happened to me definitely when we've been looking. I don't know, things like, for example, Christmas lights. You know, all of a sudden you you put a certain type of Christmas lights up and then all of a sudden you see them everywhere, and they were probably there before, but you just didn't notice them before. So this is really common.
That's a good point. I've been lazy in putting up Christmas lights, but that makes sense. Let's see. Another one on this list here is the ostrich effect. I think that this one is got a cool name. The ostrich effect is a tendency to ignore negative information. And this is, again, where a mastermind or group of people who can point out the places where you're viewing a situation wrong can really be of help, because the ostrich effect is essentially named because you, quote unquote, bury your head in the sand and you ignore this negative information. I think of that meme of the dog in the kitchen with the fire blazing all around it and saying, this is fine.
One of my favorites. Yeah, this is what somewhere where having a mentor can be really helpful as well, because they presumably have seen a lot of situations and they'll help you point out negative information that you're either ignoring or maybe haven't even thought of.
Yeah, I think that this could be really important, especially if you are hanging on to a particular belief, or you're maybe, you know, you're in a particular industry and you're refusing to believe that your product, for example, isn't a great fit. We were talking about in the last episode, we were talking about the innovator's dilemma and companies like Kodak, for example, that kind of missed the boat in terms of digital photography and how they're not alone. You know, BlackBerry did the same thing, or Research in Motion with the iPhone, because they believed that no one would take a phone seriously that didn't have a physical keyboard. And a lot of times these companies are in position to just own the market if they could just project where it's going to go. But they so believe that. And yeah, Nate points out Kodak had a working digital camera in 1979. Yeah, absolutely. Most of the time, they're the first ones to explore these technologies, but they look at how they did last quarter or what their customers are currently asking for. And they say, oh, we don't need digital photography. We need more of these film cameras because that's what people are asking for. And then you end up in a situation where all of a sudden you don't have a place in the market anymore. And I think that there's a fine line there. There's a point where you can find yourself in a place where it's very clear that the market is going in a specific direction.
I still think the Kodak Disc was an awesome camera. There has to be one person listening to this who will know what I'm talking about.
But. Yeah, I got to admit, I don't know, so I apologize. But I think that there are definitely points where you have to identify, and having somebody to help you overcome the cognitive bias of the ostrich effect could be really valuable, who can just say, you know, dude, the ship has sailed. It's time to shift the focus to the new thing. As an example, the company I was working at before I started working with Asian Efficiency was a family software company. And we made the leap from installable software to cloud-based software, mainly because I was a very vocal proponent of the cloud-based stuff. But there were a lot of people in our industry who just continued to produce the widgets, and they had the warehouses and things like that. And they had a hard time letting go of what had traditionally worked in the past.
Oh yeah, that is so common. Yeah, I referenced my wife's company earlier that makes machine vision cameras, and that is something that's plaguing their industry. Is they had something that worked well for them, so they want a certain type of connector or whatever, so they want to just keep going with it. But if everything's moving a different direction, you know, eventually it's going to catch up to you.
Yep, definitely. And so also in the chat, and it's talking about the Kodak example being more of a perfect example, not recognizing the impact of that technology. So, I mean, we don't have this on the list, but essentially it's the opposite of one that we talked about before with the pre-innovation bias, where you overvalue the contribution of a technology. So I think the flip side of that cognitive bias could be also undervaluing the contribution of a particular technology.
One thing I want to bring up, since Nate had mentioned it a number of times, is the loss of aversion bias. Mm-hmm. And, you know, study. And I'm mainly bringing up because I think he has something to say about it in the chat. So hopefully he'll chime in. But study after study has shown that I've read it in multiple books, that people, when they're faced with a choice between a somewhat certain gaining something, will always choose not losing it. Like they overweight the concept of losing. the pain of losing something, even if the reward can be way greater. So that is a really common bias as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that specifically that could be applied to, we talked about, you know, how do you hit the reset button? How do you make a fresh start in terms of like making a career change? It can be really scary to quote unquote make the leap. And so I think that that's definitely one area where that might play out. Nate also mentions going to a concert in the rain when you have the flu.
Yeah. Or yeah. I have this problem too when this is kind of a silly example, but with food, like let's say I buy, I don't know, a type of coffee or whatever, and I don't like it. I will keep drinking this coffee and keep grinding the beans and drink it because I bought it and I don't want to throw it away. But really I'm not enjoying it. So my refusing to lose this, whatever $9 that I spent on this bag of coffee is overweighting the misery I have every day drinking this garbage coffee. So this is something I'm trying to work on with myself.
I think I am so much of a coffee snob that example, yeah, that's not doesn't a problem resonate for you. let's see. Also on this list, and again, I know we're not going to get all of the cognitive biases, but these are the big ones that, at least from my research, you know, it jumped out at me. The placebo effect was one that I thought was interesting. And this is essentially when you believe that something will provide a desired result and you actually get the result regardless of the quality of the item. So most people think of like the placebo effect when it comes to sugar pills, for example, where you believe that you're going to take this pill and it's going to help you feel better. And the research has shown that as long as people believe that the pill is going to make them feel better, that sometimes that does actually happen, which is kind of where I think it gets this name. But you can, again, I mean, apply this a lot of different places in the productivity space.
Yep, definitely.
All right. Another one here is salience. And this is essentially focusing on the most easily recognizable aspect of a particular thing. And so these are kind of associations that we draw with an event that kind of color what the event is actually, it's actually going to be like. So for example, when I was researching this, the example they had was you picture death in the form of, like, if you're right now, I'm 35, for example, and so you typically don't think about the end of your life, but someone in my age bracket might think about death and they might think of all the horrible ways that they might die tomorrow because that's how they might end their life given their current framing again. But so you might think of things like crossing the street and getting hit by a car, or the example I saw online was getting eaten by a lion. all of these things that produce these negative feelings towards the event, but they're not really justifiable. They're you know, colored through this cognitive bias.
Yeah, another example might be like, let's say you have a project at work, and if you look at it objectively, it went really well. Like maybe it was a success. People really liked it. Things mostly went okay. But say there was one day where, I don't know, there was something blew up and it was a real pain to deal with. Well, when you think back on that project, chances are you're going to think of that one day, even though the rest of it was a success. Another example that pops to mind is public speaking. Like let's say you give a talk at a conference, hypothetically, even though this happened to me. let's say you give a talk at a conference and you get back amazing reviews. Like people are like, this is the best session ever. I loved it, blah, blah, blah. But there was one person that really didn't like it and gave a review like that. When you think of it, you're going to think of that one review that was negative, even though everything else was amazing. So those are two examples.
Yeah, those are great examples. Nate actually calls out another one, which is definitely worth covering. And that's the gambler's fallacy. And this is the tendency to assume that individual random events are influenced by previous random events. So this is, he used the example. So I want to make sure I give Nate credit for this. You know, you flip heads with a coin five times consecutively. So the chance of tails coming out on the six flip is greater. but that is not necessarily true. That is not the case. So, and he mentions that luck is an extension of the gambler's fallacy. So I can definitely see where this would definitely play into, especially in the gambling situation where, you know, you're looking for these patterns and then projecting things based off of the patterns that you identify out of the random events. All right. So that's a lot of different cognitive biases. Maybe we should switch over here to how to deal with some of these cognitive biases.
Excellent idea.
Okay. So essentially there's four basic strategies on how to deal with cognitive biases at a high level. And so the first one is recognition. I remember when I was growing up, there was a cartoon, G.I. Joe, and at the end of every episode, they would have some community service type message, like always wear a helmet sort of a thing. And the tagline was always, now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
That's a strong reference there. That was well done. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily know that knowing is half the battle, but it is important to recognize that these things do actually exist. And just by knowing that they exist, sometimes we can kind of compensate and take steps to overcome these things. So that's the first tip, the recognition. The second one is incentives. And so this is essentially where a lot of the mastermind type stuff would come in, because it's essentially becoming accountable for your decisions. You know, when you, there's a saying that people play different when they're keeping score. And that's essentially what this is it's making yourself accountable for the decisions that you make. And if you know that other people are going to take you to task because you made this poor decision and you didn't take into account these cognitive biases, then that can actually be enough to help you overcome them, that incentive to make the right choice instead of just doing what's easiest for your brain.
Some people take this to an extreme too. They have deals with people saying, oh, if I don't do this, or if I do this, you know, I have to pay $100 or something like that. Or I even heard of one product out there where it's some sort of bracelet that you wear. And when you don't make the right decision that you had set out, I don't know exactly how it works, it basically gives you an electric shock. That seems pretty extreme to me, but I guess some people swear by it.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be implementing that strategy. Yep. To help me overcome my cognitive biases.
Nope.
The third strategy is nudges. And so these are little things that you can do to kind of nudge you towards making a better decision. An example of a nudge might be understanding the health benefits of eating fruits and vegetables or eating clean, and then that could actually result in better dietary choices. Now, this doesn't always work, but this is a strategy. I know from the Rituals product that there was a research study done by the British Journal of Psychology, I believe. And what they found was that they had a bunch of people, and they had three groups, the focus group. They tracked how often people actually made it to the gym. Their goal was to go to the gym at least once a week. And so there was a certain percentage that made it. When they said they had this goal, there was another group that implemented the nudges. And in this particular study, they understood the benefits of exercise and they actually went down the number of people who actually followed through in their goal. Another example would be the third group, which actually wrote it down. And the majority of them, I think it was like 90%, actually achieved their goal of going to the gym. So writing things down could also be an example of a nudge. Nate mentions the environment design as a strategy. I think that's definitely something that would definitely be classified as a nudge. Because a nudge is essentially all of these little things that you can do to kind of push you towards making the right decision. I think that the dojo community could be a nudge for a lot of people who just need a little bit more accountability. You know, we've got a whole section in the forum for people who have posted their 12-week year goals. So like that is a form of a nudge as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things you can do. sometimes documentaries can be a good way too. You always hear about there's some documentary on a certain subject and it gets really popular. And then all of a sudden people are starting to change their behaviors because of it. So there's all types of different nudges that you can use it, and different thing ones work for different people. So sometimes you just got to play around and try different things. If it doesn't happen for you the first time, doesn't necessarily mean that you're hopeless. It just means you may need to just change the nudges a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, really the goal of the nudges, Nate's asking, eliminating bad decisions and decision fatigue. I would say yes, but nudges are the small tactical things that you would do to help you specifically overcome those particular cognitive biases that would color those decisions. And that's going to be different than the fourth one here, which is the training. And the training is the recognizing the patterns and applying the appropriate responses. So an example of training would be like a pre-flight checklist for an airline pilot. And this is common in firefighting, weather forecasting, the airline industry. In fact, I read a book called The Checklist Manifesto, which talked about this. I think medicine is another area where this is very valuable. And actually, the author of The Checklist Manifesto, Atul Gawande, is a surgeon. And his research shows that when people had a checklist to follow, they were much more likely to be successful in the task. And there was, again, an example of a cognitive bias when he did the research and he showed surgeons, for example, that if they used this checklist, that they were going to be much more successful. All of the surgeons said that they wanted people, if they were the ones going under the knife, that they would want the surgeon that was operating on them to use the checklist. But then the majority of them thought that they didn't necessarily need that checklist, that they could overcome that. And that again is an example of the overconfidence bias, as Nate points out in the chat.
Yeah, and this, there can be a lot of things around this as well. It's all about building things in a way that kind of, if you know what your biases are, which is part of the recognition, then you can start coming up with a plan to get around them, and that's where the training comes in. So the checklist is a great example. Putting together that mastermind, which we talked about earlier, to help you get in that way. There's all sorts of things you can do to take you down that path, but you got to recognize it first.
Yeah, definitely. So just to recap, four different strategies here, and the specifics of these strategies are going to look different for every single person, but from a high level, four strategies you can use to deal with your cognitive biases. Number one, the recognition. Number two, the incentives, where you become accountable for your decisions. Number three, the nudges, the tactical things that you would do to kind of push you in the right direction. And then number four, the training. And that's going to be like the checklist. And then an additional resource, which is great. And I am not all the way through this book, but it was recommended to me by Tan, is The Art of Thinking Clearly. And this is by Rolf Dubelli. I'm not sure how to pronounce that name, but it is a great book, and it's roughly 300 pages, but there's essentially 100 different chapters, and each chapter is a couple pages on a specific cognitive bias. And so, like I said, this is really just the tip of the iceberg when we're talking about cognitive biases. So maybe we'll have a follow-up episode to this, but if you're looking for more information on cognitive biases, definitely check out The Art of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, I just started it too. And great book so far. It's funny, you look at the table of contents and you're like, what the heck? Because there's so many chapters. But yeah, I like the way he broke it up.
Yeah, and again, just to reiterate, not confessing to be an expert on this particular topic. I'm learning a lot the more research that I do on this. But I think The Art of Thinking Clearly is a great place to start. This episode was not only inspired by the dojo, but it was actually recorded live in front of our dojo audience. The dojo is our online productivity community where you can connect with like-minded achievers, and it's the place to go if you want to be a part of the conversation and surround yourself with people who can help you overcome your own cognitive biases to achieve your goals. Access to the dojo is limited and usually costs $29 a month, but if you go to theproductivityshow.com/dojo, you can not only get access to the community, but also the entire private video training library for only $1 for the first month. That's right, you get access to everything the dojo has to offer, including the private video training library, for just $1 for the first month. After that, it's just $29 a month, and you can cancel at any time. With membership to the dojo, you also get exclusive software discounts on some of our favorite productivity apps like BusyCal, Hazel, and Text Expander. So if you want to join a community that can help you not just talk about, but take action on and achieve your goals, check out the dojo today by going to theproductivityshow.com/dojo. Again, that URL is theproductivityshow.com/dojo. You can also find links to everything that we discussed today in the show notes by going to theproductivityshow.com/152. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next Productive Monday.